Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel for the afternoon is to my right, Justice Bonnie Sutterth, to my left, Justice Elizabeth Kerr, and I'm Lee Gabriel. And we will begin with our first case. If the clerk will call the case, please.
The court will now call Catherine Van Der Linden versus Dr. Nadine Tom. Next to court is Mr. Thomas J. Williams for arguing for the appellant. Mr. Greg Eisel will argue for the appellee.
Mr. Williams?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. This case illustrates the significance of the requirement in the Texas Citizens Participation Act that a non-movement seeking to defeat a motion to dismiss must establish by clear and specific evidence a prima facie case of each element of each claim pled. And Dr. Kahn simply did not meet that burden. And as a result, the case should have been dismissed in the trial court, and we believe the appropriate disposition in this court is to reverse and render judgment that the case be dismissed. We discussed in our briefing in this court the applicability of the statute and all of the various elements of the various causes of action that Dr. Kahn pled. And I'm going to leave much of it to the briefing, but I do want to take a few moments this afternoon to elaborate a bit on some of the elements of some of Dr. Kahn's claims for which his evidence is noticeably deficient and strikingly fails to meet the clear and specific standard that the Texas Citizens Participation Act requires. And specifically, I'd like to focus on, with respect to his tortious interference claims, the absence of evidence of a contract, the absence of evidence of a reasonable probability there was ever going to be a contract, and the absence of evidence that Van Der Linden's statement caused Dr. Kahn any damages.
Now, if it's defamation per se, we don't have to worry about those damages, do we?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And wouldn't you think that alleging that someone gave aid to the Taliban would be defamation per se?
I think the way Dr. Kahn pled it, of course, he pled it as defamation and or defamation per se.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, a traditional, if that's the right word, defamation claim does require damages as an element, but as the court said, per se does not. I think this perhaps, at least for purposes of this early motion to dismiss, could be treated as that. But the element that he failed to establish as to his defamation per se claim is negligence. Defamation per se does relieve the plaintiff of the obligation to prove damages, because presumed damages can be recovered. But even in a defamation per se case with private parties, such as we have here, the plaintiff still must establish negligence. Hancock versus Varian was the Supreme Court case that told us that. This court reaffirmed that in the Cummins versus Batworld case. And that's the element Dr. Kahn failed to establish on his defamation per se claim. His final claim that he pled was one for an injunction. And with respect to that claim, Dr. Kahn's claim fails as a matter of law in light of the Kinney versus Barnes decision from the Supreme Court, regardless of what his evidence might be. Now, with respect to Dr. Kahn's pleadings in the trial court, just sequentially, the first claim he pled was for tortious interference with contract. In his original petition, he didn't even claim to have a contract. But then he amended after Van Der Linden had filed her motion to dismiss, and just within a few days of the hearing in the trial court on that motion. And he said, well, I had a verbal agreement with this man named Sheldon Murphy for this hydrocarbon deal, and then separately I was working on another agreement with Sheldon Murphy to buy 50% of this company called WAM LLC. It's the latter claim that is his, as I understand his pleadings and his affidavit, his tortious interference with prospective contract claim. But with respect to contract, he claims he has this oral agreement with Sheldon Murphy concerning the sale of crude oil or hydrocarbon products. Now, the only evidence Dr. Kahn brought forth is his own affidavit. We have no affidavit from Sheldon Murphy. We have no affidavit from anybody else. We have no discovery, And we have no request by Dr. Khan in the trial court to take discovery, which the statute does allow, but he did not seek. And so all we have is his own affidavit, and all he tells us about this claimed oral contract is at paragraph 11 of his supplemental affidavit. It's found in the clerk's record at page 194. And I think it's instructive to look carefully at what he said, not only for what Dr. Khan said, but for what he didn't say. And what he says is that with respect to this claimed oral agreement with Mr. Murphy, he says, Dr. Khan, I would find a seller-producer to sell crude oil and or other hydrocarbon products. The crude oil and or other hydrocarbon products would be provided by a third party. Sheldon Murphy and I would split the greater of 10 cents or 10% of the margin per barrel for the crude oil. I, Dr. Khan, had found a seller-producer to purchase 60,000 metric tons of crude oil, and my commission would have been approximately $30,000. That's all our evidence we have. And what is noticeably absent is any evidence as to what Sheldon Murphy was supposed to do under this claimed verbal agreement. There's no indication of Sheldon Murphy's obligations. There's no indication of the forming of this oral agreement. No evidence, even from Dr. Khan himself, much less Mr. Murphy, as to what discussions the parties entered into to lead to the formation of this claimed oral agreement. But again, without mutuality of consideration, there can be no contract. Without a contract, a tortious interference with contract claim must fail. That claim fails for the additional reason that without knowing what Sheldon Murphy was obligated to do, we have no evidence that he breached. And a second element of a tortious interference with contract claim is that the defendant actually induced somebody to breach the contract. In this court, in the All-American Telephone versus USLD case, and several other courts and other cases have held that just inducing someone to do that which they are entitled to do does not give rise to a tortious interference claim. So for at least those two reasons, he failed to establish by clear and specific evidence his prima facie claim for tortious interference with contract. Now, with respect to prospective contract, it's the same deficiency. We really don't have, we have nothing from Mr. Murphy, so we have no evidence that there was a reasonable probability that the parties were going to enter into this agreement.
Do you think that an affidavit from Mr. Murphy was a necessity?
I don't see how he could have established that element without something, either an affidavit from Mr. Murphy, he could have sought leave to go take his deposition, or perhaps, I mean, obviously these aren't supposed to be written contracts, but if they were, there could have been a written contract that Dr. Khan himself could have established. But in an oral agreement and in oral discussions supposedly leading to a prospective agreement, I do think we need something from the other party to the agreement. Yes, Your Honor. The other deficiency, I think, besides the absence of evidence that a contract was reasonably probable, again, since we know nothing from Mr. Murphy, even Dr. Khan himself only says, I had asked Murphy to sell an interest in this company to me, and then we hired an attorney to begin drafting some papers. But he also fails on the element of damages as to his prospective contract claim. What Dr. Khan tells us in his affidavit as to that issue, and this is at paragraph 15 of his supplemental affidavit, he says, Dr. Khan, I studied the project and its potential for profit sufficiently to form the opinion, based on my experience and education, that I would make a substantial profit from that project, certainly more than $1 million. And then he says he incurred attorney's fees. And that's all the testimony we have as to claimed damages. And it's testimony, it seems to me, that is strikingly similar to the affidavit that the executive from Range Resources put forward in the Lipsky case. In that case, the executive from Range said that the statements in question had caused Range direct pecuniary and economic losses and costs, lost profits, loss of its reputation, and loss of goodwill in the communities in excess of $3 million. And the Supreme Court found that to be conclusory and failing to meet the clear and specific standard that the statute requires. This affidavit, it seems to me, has the same deficiency, and that's fatal to that second claim for tortious interference with prospective contract. Now, with respect to the defamation claims, his next claim, which we've already touched on, but a traditional, I'll use that word again, defamation claim would require the plaintiff to establish damages. Dr. Kahn does not seek or offer evidence of general reputational damages, so all he would have would be the special damages, which are the same damages he hasn't established as to the tortious interference claims. So that claim fails. Again, defamation per se does not require him to establish damages, but it does still require him to establish, or at least to have clear and specific evidence of a prima facie case for the defendant's negligence. And that's where he fails as to that claim. What Dr. Kahn says in his briefing in this court, and he also said it in the trial court, is, well, what she said was false. She told these people, I had said I gave money to the Taliban, and I never said it. So therefore it's false, and therefore she was negligent in telling people that I had said that. But the problem with that argument is it's circular, and it merges evidence of falsity with evidence of the defendant's negligence. And if the plaintiff can establish the defendant's negligence simply by establishing the falsity of the statement, then we've gone back to the strict liability system. And that started going out the window more than 40 years ago in the Gertz case, and many cases have followed. And again, we have it now in no uncertain terms in Texas in the Hancock case, and again, this court's decision in Cummins. So he still has to establish negligence as an additional element to falsity. He doesn't have to establish damages for his per se claim, that's true, but he's still got to establish negligence, and his evidence of falsity is no evidence of Ms. Vanderlinden's negligence, and so that claim fails for that reason. And as a result, all of his substantive claims have at least one, in some cases more than one, element for which Dr. Kahn has brought forth really no evidence, and certainly not clear and specific evidence of the elements of the claim. Now, Dr. Kahn also sought injunctive relief, and as we set forth in the briefing, that claim fails just simply as a matter of law. The seminal case, of course, is Kenny versus Barnes. And what the Supreme Court told us in Kenny versus Barnes is that the Constitution would permit an order instructing a defendant to remove a post that had been found to be defamatory, but that the Constitution would not permit an order to the defendant not to repeat it again in the future. Well, in our case, what Dr. Kahn asked for is that second type of injunction that Kenny versus Barnes told us would still be unconstitutional. And there's nothing for her to bring down. It's not a post. So that claim fails. The last thing I want to mention very briefly, I want to speak to the possibility of a partial reversal. I think for the reasons we've talked about in our briefing, the entire case should be reversed. But if this court believes that even one claim should be reversed, then when it goes back to the trial court must award fees and costs under Section 27.009. If there's any doubt about that, the Supreme Court put it to rest just this past Friday, like 4 or 5 days ago, in D Magazine versus Rosenthal, in which that issue came up, and the court expressly held that a trial court that had partially granted a motion to dismiss should award fees. If it would be appropriate, because that case is so recent, I might ask to submit a brief post-submission letter brief just transmitting the case and calling that passage to the court's attention, if the court would like.
Further questions? Thank you. Mr. Eisner?
Good afternoon. My name is Greg Eister. with the law firm Hill Gilstrap, and we represent Dr. Nadeem Khan in his lawsuit that he's filed against Ms. Vanderlinden. Not just to refresh the court regarding the facts in this case, Ms. Vanderlinden sent a statement to Dr. Khan's business partners, and in her affidavit attached to the motion to dismiss, she states that she tracked his business partners down, and I even believe she used the language possible regarding a possible business venture. She then sent the Facebook message to his business partners, the Murphys, and saying that Dr. Khan had told her that he had given money to the Taliban. She began the statement by saying, "You are partnering with a Muslim who has personally told her that he has given money to the Taliban." Dr. Khan, in his affidavit, has denied that he ever gave money to the Taliban. He's denied that he's ever said that he gave money to the Taliban. The issue that, and I don't think that they can, and I think Mr. Williams acknowledged that it is defamatory, and it's defamatory per se to make such a statement. And he focuses much on our evidentiary, or he focuses on his evidentiary objections. I'd just like to point out to the court that we had the burden to provide clear and specific evidence, or prima facie evidence, which requires a non-movement to provide enough detail to show the factual basis for his claim. That's Henry Lipsky. And prima facie evidence is that minimum quantum of evidence necessary to support a rational inference that the allegation of fact is true.
What evidence is out there of negligence on Vanderlinden's part?
Well, I
because that's what your opposing counsel points to in the defamation per se. He says absent from the evidence is any evidence. Absent is any evidence of negligence.
Yes,
so what would you point us to say, here's the evidence, clear and specific evidence as to negligence?
I think we go past negligence and prove actual malice. The fact that she tracked his business partner down and made a false statement, the fact that he's denied that in an affidavit, that he ever made that statement, that he's ever given money to the Taliban, and the fact that he denied ever making that statement to her. I believe when you make that puts the issue in its proper context, that it's a false statement. And that's all we have to do at this point in this case, is to do a prima facie case of negligence.
So are you saying that it's not negligence isn't the only element that you can choose to prove either negligence or intent, actual intent?
Well, I might not.
Because you said actual malice, which is an intentional act, or a wanton disregard for the truth or falsity. So are you saying that it's not that negligence isn't a part of the proof, but in fact you can not prove negligence and instead substitute actual malice for that element?
I probably didn't say it very well, Your Honor. What I was attempting to do was show we can prove negligence, which we have to prove in defamation case.
And what proof is in the record of that?
That the proof that she made the statement, that Dr. Khan denied ever making the statement. I'd point to the court to a recent case called Ford v. Bland. It's a Houston Court of Appeals case. It's an unpublished case, 2016, Westlaw 732-3309. And that was a case where it was just controverting affidavits, that where one person denied that they ever made a defamatory statement. And that was enough to prove, to put the issue in its proper context regarding negligence.
So you're saying that this case says that you really don't have to prove negligence?
No, and I'm sorry if I say that, but...
Just the making of a statement that's untrue then in your mind is negligence?
Yes, Your Honor. Especially when Dr. Khan has denied making such a statement.
Doesn't that just eliminate that responsibility? What you've just said, there's no responsibility to prove by clear and specific evidence negligence, because one person says, I said it because he said it to me, and the other person says, I didn't say it. So you've got a swearing match, and that's all you need?
I believe, Your Honor, that at this point in this case, that we have to establish a prima facie case, and which can be established through circumstantial evidence. And, you know, how do we prove a negative? How do we prove, I mean, it was Ms. Vanderlyn's statement that Dr. Kahn said that. We've said now that she published that statement with disregard for the truth, which is that he never made that statement. If you look at the evidence and you look at the circumstantial evidence, the fact that Dr. Kahn has denied making such a statement, and Ms. Vanderlyn went out 5 months after the purported statement was made, sought out his business partners, which she acknowledges, and then publishes that statement. I believe those actions constitute, at least at a minimum, negligent conduct.
Well, how could, let me see if I can figure out even how to phrase this question, how could a movement under the TCPA ever get a case dismissed if all it takes is the other party saying, I never said it?
I'm obviously talking about defamation cases. I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. But in this specific case, the only thing I can do at this point is point to what we believe is at least circumstantial evidence of negligent conduct.
What is the circumstantial evidence?
The circumstantial evidence, rational inferences from this conduct. The circumstantial evidence is she tracked his partners down. She states in her affidavit it was to interfere or to contact to stop this business relationship. Circumstantially, and what happened was after that was, and it kind of goes to Mr. Shelton's or Shelton Murphy's conduct after he received that message that he would no longer go forward with the contract. At a minimum, that was circumstantial evidence that because of that statement, he would no longer go forward with the contract.
But that's your tortious interference claim.
Right, but it's the same set of facts for all of those. It goes to, for our defamation, it goes to our damages argument as well. Regarding the contract to sell crude oil, Dr. Kahn did. He provided the names to the contract, Dr. Kahn and Sheldon Murphy. He provided the terms that Dr. Kahn was to provide a seller producer to sell crude oil and other hydrocarbon products, that the terms of the agreement were that he would split the greater of 10 cents or 10% of the margin per barrel of each crude oil or other hydrocarbon products sold. Dr. Kahn further testified in his affidavit that he had found a seller producer of 60,000 metric tons of crude oil, and that his commission under the contract was going to be $30,000.
So Mr. Murphy had no obligations under this contract. He was just along for the ride to get that 10 cents or 10%.
Well, it appears the affidavit could have been a little bit clearer, but I think the court can infer that he was going to be a partner with Dr. Kahn.
The standard is clear and specific evidence. Are we really supposed to fill in the blanks and infer?
I don't think you have to fill in the blanks. And I think that we've established a minimum quantum of evidence that there was a contract to produce it, to sell oil, and that they would split the commissions. Regarding the prospective relationship, Dr. Kahn and Sheldon Murphy had agreed, and this is in the affidavit, that Dr. Kahn was going to purchase their interest in the oil company WAM in Wyoming. They had gone so far as to prepare numerous documents, including a transfer of membership interest, a membership control agreement, a WAM operating agreement, all of which documents are in evidence. Dr. Kahn further testified that he had spent $250,000 in attorney's fees on that agreement and during those negotiations. So the issue is, we believe, as we've established, that there was going to be a reasonable probability of entering into a contract, and that we had proved damages in this case in that, on that regard.
But as far as causation, I'm looking at paragraph 14 of Dr. Kahn's supplemental affidavit, and even that doesn't seem to really say in so many words, yes, Mr. Murphy saw this post, and then he said, because of that, I'm not going to proceed. I mean, can we really, is that a gap that you think it's appropriate for us to fill in as far as that specific element?
I do. I think so. At this phase, this isn't a summary judgment or a trial phase. This case was just filed, and they filed a motion to dismiss, and discovery was stayed. But the statement is, in paragraph 14, that he had just received the false and defamatory statement at issue, and then stated that he could not proceed with the plan. In paragraph 16, Dr. Kahn stated that they refused to go forward immediately after Mr. Murphy received the statement. Further, Dr. Kahn testified he can think of no other reason other than those false statements for their refusal to go forward. And I believe using rational inferences from that and the conduct of Sheldon Murphy immediately after receiving the statement of Ms. Vanderlinden, their failure or their refusal to proceed forward with the plan does establish causation.
Now, would your client, I understand discovery stayed, but you agree that your client could have asked for limited discovery directed toward this motion?
Correct.
And would that, could he also have submitted an affidavit for Mr. Murphy without having gone through a formal request to lift the stay?
Perhaps, Your Honor. I don't know the answer to that. I do know that Sheldon Murphy was in receipt of Ms. Vanderlinden's statement that he was about to partner with a terrorist, and that that Dr. Kahn, as far as what I know, is that they wouldn't go forward with the plan. If discovery had not been stayed and we were allowed to proceed with the case, we could subpoena the documents and communications and get the answer to that question as to whether or not and determine that further for a summary judgment or even trial. But at this phase, where we're supposed to establish just a minimum quantum of evidence to establish their case, I believe that we have. I believe we've also established the requisite standard. We've met the standard of proof required for defamation and defamation per se. And if there aren't any further questions, I'll reserve my time. Thank you, Your Honor. Excuse me.
Just to a couple of points that came up in Mr. Eister's comments. First, as to the procedural posture of discovery, and to Justice Kerr's question, he absolutely could have submitted an affidavit from Sheldon Murphy or from anybody else without leave of court. And as to the claim need to subpoena documents or undertake discovery, he could have sought leave to do that. He didn't do that. I want to speak in some detail to the issue of negligence. As to the defamation per se claim, I think eventually Dr. Kahn's counsel said that the making of the untrue statement itself is the evidence of negligence. And if that's the case, then we're going back to strict liability. And that's not been the law for more than 40 years. And Hancock, Cummins versus Batworld tells us it's not the law, even in a per se case with private parties, which is what we've got here.
What is your response to his argument that actually what he's shown is actual malice because she sought out his business partners and sent this false post?
Well, actual malice is actually a higher standard. That's a more difficult standard for the plaintiff.
It's a more difficult standard, but is negligence subsumed in that, or is it kind of a separate standard under the Boyles versus Kerr?
Yeah, and you know, Bentley versus Button, you know, those kinds of cases. I really think it's subsumed because it all goes to the defendant's knowledge or lack of knowledge as to the truth or falsity of the statement. It's not common law ill will malice. And so, you know, I mean, typically a private plaintiff, such as we have here, only wants to meet the negligence standard, which is all they're required to meet, because it's so much lower. And actual malice is really either that the defendant knew it was false or acted with reckless disregard as to the truth or falsity. Whereas negligence, I either knew it was false or was negligent in speaking without knowledge of the truth or falsity. But in any event, he doesn't have evidence of either. He has evidence that she contacted people he calls business partners, and I would take issue with that conclusion. That's to our point on the tortious interference claim. We hadn't established that they were partners, but in any event. But that's not evidence as to her state of mind as to the truth or falsity.
Could you ever have negligence in a situation where the person who repeated the statement believes they heard it with their own ears? I see the negligence where I hear it from someone else that so-and-so said it,
right,
and then I just repeat it negligently.
Right.
But if you think you heard it with your own ears, could that ever rise to the level of negligence?
I'm not sure it could. But otherwise, then it's as Justice Kerr said, the movement can never win. You're right, Justice Souter. Typically, especially in news media cases where it most typically comes up, well, my source told me this guy gave money to the Taliban, and based on that, I put it in the newspaper or put it on television. And that's not our case. So here, where she says, and you know, in some detail, he said it to me, and that's what she reports, is that I was told personally, not via hearsay, she makes a point of saying that, then it's a different dynamic. And he might have evidence of falsity from his own affidavit, but he doesn't have evidence of the defendant's negligence from that.
And if she acted in willful disregard, assuming there was evidence, would that constitute negligence in your mind? That would be, negligence would be subsumed.
I think that's right.
But there's
sure.
No evidence of that, you're saying.
That's right. I mean, if you had a case where the defendant just made it up, that would probably rise to the level of actual malice, and certainly to the level of negligence.
And negligence would be in that as well.
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor. And again, Your Honor, I just repeat what I said a moment ago about the staying of discovery. There is the provision for a plaintiff to seek leave. It's designed exactly for that problem that Mr. Eister talked about, that it's preliminary and discovery would not otherwise have been taken, but he did not see fit to avail himself of that opportunity.
I have one other question about the tortious interference with the contract. How much details should someone have to go through in their affidavit to talk about the duties and responsibilities of the various parties to the contract? I mean, is it enough to say, you seem to argue that it's not enough to say, hey, we had a contract that we were going to do this, and then be silent as to the duties of each side. But do you really have to go into the detail of everything that each party to the contract had to do?
I'm not sure you'd have to go to that much detail, but you sure got to have more than he did here, especially keeping in mind it's an oral contract. If it were written, presumably we'd just look to the document. But we don't have any elements of this contract. I think the closest case I can direct the court to, and it's cited by both parties in the briefing, is Serafin versus Blunt. And the guy says, well, I hired this landscaping company to come put in some French drains in my house, and the other guy did whatever he did, and that tortiously interfered with the contract. The Austin Court of Appeals said he did not establish a prima facie case of a contract because there was really no detail about exactly what were the terms of this agreement with the landscaping company, who was supposed to do what would be a breach, and that's what we're missing here. The only thing we have here is that I'm May I finish this answer? I'm obviously past time.
I'm fine with it. Okay.
The only thing we have here is the Sheldon Murphy's going to get some of the proceeds, even though we have no evidence of what he's doing to earn it.
Thank you very much. If you want to submit your post-submission letter brief, just do so by this Friday, and just don't make it argumentative. Just submit the case.
We will, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you both for your briefing and for your arguments here today. Your case is submitted, and you are excused.